That's Art Davis on bass, followed by Hank Jones on piano, opening 4 and 6 with the star of this piece, Elvin Jones on drums, subtly and beautifully in charge. This is from Elvin Jones's studio album, Elvin, released in 1962. Brother Thad, virtuoso on cornet and trumpet, also performs on this album, though not on this tune. The Jones brothers from Pontiac, Michigan, are all in the pantheon of jazz greats. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, September the 16th, and the United States yesterday intensified its airstrike campaign against the Islamic State in Iraq, widening the battlefield to southwest of Baghdad, where IS forces were said to be holed up. Since August the 8th, at least 162 U.S. airstrikes have been conducted in Iraq, mostly in the north and west. Today, reports are saying that U.S. ground troops may join Iraqi forces fighting the Islamic State. When President Obama declared war against the Islamic State on the eve of the 13th anniversary of the al-Qaeda-linked September the 11th terrorist attacks in the United States, the war that is now intensified in Iraq, questions arose about the legality of his action based on U.S. constitutional law. But was he also flouting international law on why and when and even how countries may go to war? These and related questions are the focus of our discussions today. Our guest is Professor Michael Newton, an expert on transnational justice and conduct of hostilities issues. His research interests include international humanitarian law, international criminal law, special tribunals, terrorism and counterterrorism, and national security law. Over the course of his career, he has published more than 80 books, articles, and book chapters, and currently serves as senior editor of the Terrorism International Case Law Reporter, an annual series published by Oxford University Press since 2007. One of his books, Proportionality in International Law, addresses many of the issues we'll be discussing today. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Newton.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Eutrice. Thank you.
Well, the president is under attack here in the United States as well. There are questions as to whether, on the basis of the Constitution, he had exceeded his authority in declaring war. But to your mind, has the president met requirements, or is the president in line with international law in declaring war on ISIS?
The key thing to understand is that war, as understood under international law, is simply an objective test. There's no strict political definition. There's no strict set of criteria. It's an objective test and an objective measurement based on the nature of hostilities and the scale of hostilities. And one thing that's very important is that under international law, at least purely international law, the legal categorization of war is a legal fact, irrespective of the positions taken by either party. Because you can imagine a situation where one party simply refuses to acknowledge a state of armed conflict and therefore says, or purports to say, that we don't have to comply with the Geneva Conventions, we don't have to comply with any of the law regulating the resort to force because we simply don't call it that. So it's not a semantic label, it's an objective test.
Well, just the same, I mean, to the mind of the average person, when a country declares war, it usually is against another country. But here we have the United States, in fact, previously, with respect to Osama bin Laden, had declared war against an individual and an organization that the individual allegedly held. At the time. And here we have President Obama again declaring war against a non-state. So have the rules of engagement with respect to how countries declare war against each other? Have those rules changed?
Well, over the last, since 9/11, there's been some shifting, which I can explain. But the big shift is really over the last century. A century ago, in the 1907 Hague Protocols and the Hague Regulations, there was specific guidance for this, for the formalized process by which states declared war against each other. And the roots of that go very, very far back in history, all the way back to just war tradition. The idea that war ought to be the very, very last resort between states. Therefore, we should take every available opportunity to keep states from going to war. So that bore fruit, for example, in specific requirements as to specific notice. If you do this thing, we can avoid going to war. That's law from a century ago. All the way up to 9/11, there was a debate about whether a state, the United States or any other state, could technically be in a state of war, or to use the correct international law term, a state of armed conflict with a non-state actor like Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab or ISIS or anybody else. 9/11 effectively changed that. As a matter of customary international law, every country around the world, the UN Security Council, NATO acted under Article 5 on the basis of the United States' right to self-defense. So after 9/11, there's no question really legally that you can in fact be in a state of armed conflict even with a non-state actor. But as I said before, you still have to be very clear that the criteria for such an armed conflict are met. And that gets to things like the nature of the hostilities and the scope of the violence and the need for military force as opposed to law enforcement. So you can technically be in a state of armed conflict, but there's an awful lot of law that goes with that.
Is this change reflected in the conventions that the United Nations upholds?
Oh, no. There's no formalized treaties that reflect this current understanding, because, in fact, it's reflected in state practice. So when states make diplomatic statements, they're actually shaping international law. And the real evolution here, just so I'm clear, is nobody ever doubted the right of a state to respond in self-defense against any threat, anybody, state or non-state. So the right of self-defense has always been clearly established. But because you're in the restricted domain, you know, we think of self-defense as being the aberration. We're in the time of peace. We have to use self-defense. Therefore, it's limited. It's the exception. When we talk about moving into a state of armed conflict, much of the legal domain and many of the legal rules, therefore, change accordingly. And so this is why this is a rather momentous step to say that, okay, we're no longer in the constrained realm of pure self-defense. We've now moved into a different realm where the laws and customs of war are appropriate, where the legal regime gives us much more flexibility. That's why this legal distinction is vitally important.
Time as well, since the international community looks to the international body to have some kind of a regulatory influence on how states engage in war and warfare, either with each other or with a non-state entity. If the thinking, if the shift outside, the shift that has occurred within the states is not reflected in the United Nations, for example, this international body that also supposedly bears such an incredible influence in how the world conducts itself, then what you're saying is that right now it's a kind of a free-for-all.
Well, I wouldn't say free-for-all. I would say that the law is much, much less precise in terms of precise guidance and where we are in the legal regime. I mean, remember, after 9/11, both the UN Security Council, NATO, the European Parliament, every country around the world recognized the United States' right of self-defense against a non-state actor, and therefore, by extension, recognized that the nature of the hostilities between the United States and Al-Qaeda was of such a level of magnitude, and that there was permissible uses of force in association with that. But then when you talk about war, you're talking about not merely defensive actions, but offensive actions. You're talking about the necessity, for example, not only to use force as a very last resort, but to use force in accordance with the laws and customs of warfare as appropriate in any way that's otherwise lawful. That's why I say it's not a free-for-all. There's a lot of law there, but the categorizations that you're in matter greatly to the type of force you can use, to the scope of that force, to the geographical scope, to the burdens of proof, who bears responsibility for showing violations, coordination mechanisms, who must the United States coordinate with, if anyone. There's a whole range of issues that flow from the legal categorizations and a whole lot of law that's applicable.
Well, this is a particularly touchy situation because the target, the intended target of the United States, is in another country at the moment.
Yes.
And we're hearing that airstrikes not only have intensified, but the battlefield has broadened. And now the question is, that country or those countries, namely Iraq and Syria, with the announced declaration of war by the president, are they now entitled to take preemptive or defensive action?
Well, you put your finger on one of the very many complex issues here. In a classic self-defense scenario, the state is legally obligated to refrain from use of force against the territorial independence or political integrity of another state. And the idea being that we don't want states using force against each other or on each other's territory because the consequences to world peace are so high. So the right to use force on somebody else's territory is very, very constrained. It's very, very narrow, only as a last resort. And only then, only to the extent strictly necessary to eliminate the threat. So it's a very narrow category of defensive countermeasures, defensive use of force, only in self-defense. But what we're talking about here is a bigger shift to offensive uses of force, even though they're on the territory of another state. So the big key to unlocking all of that under international principles of sovereignty would be for those territorial states simply to grant us blanket permission to use force on their territory in a certain category of cases against a certain category of opponents. So, in theory, both Syria or Iraq could grant the United States affirmative permission to use force. And then the question would be, against which enemy, in which targets, in which areas, and is there a requirement for pre-coordination in terms of airspace flow, in terms of flows of refugees? The United States, I can imagine, would stringently, vehemently object to pre-coordination requirements. That's not the way we fight our wars, because we lose the element of surprise. It endangers our intelligence collection, and it makes the targeting that much less effective. So, absent state consent here, that's why these legal categorizations matter. Are you in a pure defensive armed conflict where you're allowed to use force very narrowly, only when it's imminent or in response to an imminent threat, or even a much broader category where the states have agreed that that's the appropriate category for the use of force?
Well, we know at least one of the states, Syria, does not agree, and we know that both of the states, in fact, have a particular history of hostility with the United States, and the United States having having invaded and worked against the interests of the seated governments at different times in both these countries. So this is, again, another complication. Here the United States is attacking a non-state entity that is within the confines of two states, which both have had issues with the United States, military experiences with the United States, have been at war and have been targeted by the United States. So in international law, How is this to be scripted? I mean, what exactly is the nature of the relationship and the conflict that is already in play?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that's the real overarching question here: is what exactly is the nature of the conflict, and how would we describe it? One of the critical things, though, that I think that has to be remembered, I rather like the statement of the Kurdish regional government's Deputy Prime Minister Kabir Talabani has said that he does not foresee a situation where another sovereign state or another quasi-state is established inside Iraq. And I think you could extend that to ISIS-controlled territory inside Syria. So at a fundamental level, I think it's important to remember that United States actions that have the effect of pushing back the amount of territory controlled by this non-state actor in either Iraq or Syria benefit those respective governments. So it's very clear that we're not acting in ways that threaten. In fact, we're acting to the extent that we're effective in such actions. We're actually benefiting the sovereign entity there. And that's one of the things that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. You know, the United States may well want to go after ISIS inside Syria, but in doing so, we're strengthening the regime that has committed such an egregious pattern of crimes and crimes against humanity and war crimes against its own civilian population. Those aren't the kind of people we want to help.
But it could be on the flip side of the same coin, that whether the United States approves or does not approve, the fact is that it was a democratically elected government and it is a sovereign state. And we can't get around that.
That's right. That's exactly right. And in international law, with respect to the territorial integrity or political independence, makes no distinctions. So you're right. The sovereign rights of the Assad regime remain in place. And having said that, there is a very, very narrow category where states do have the lawful right to use force on the territory of another state, but in very, very narrow circumstances or imminent urgent self-defense. But, you know, clearly, I mean, the counterfactual here would be if we had evidence of an impending ISIS attack directed at Americans or American interests, many scholars, me included, would argue that we have the absolute sovereign right of self-defense that extends even to the territory of other states. But that use of self-defense has to be in response to a very clear threat. It has to be an imminent threat. We have to use the smallest degree of force, most narrowly tailored to the threat. It has to be extremely limited. And that's not what we're talking about here. Because I've seen personally no evidence of very clear impending attacks. What we're talking about is a much broader articulation, which is why I think you were absolutely correct. From a layman's perspective, we're talking about a longer, more extended pattern of warfare, or to use the international law term, armed conflict, rather than just a very narrow, express, focused self-defense right. And that's why the dual sovereign rights here are equally important.
Another factor is that neither of the states has declared war against the United States. And not even the non-state entity has declared war, if in effect, against the United States. They've made statements about to that effect, but they have not physically conducted any campaign, so far as we know, against the United States. So what is the basis of this preemptive action, you think, and how will that fly under international law? That the United States is, in effect, now engaged in war against entities, none of which have actually attacked the United States.
Well, this is where we are, in fact, watching the extension of international law principles to a whole new categorization of conflict. And it's important to remember that this is not just the United States stretching those boundaries. Every state that publicly expresses its support for a coalition whether or not they actually contribute militarily to that coalition. This is important because what we're watching is a shift in the understanding of sovereign states with respect to the boundaries on the use of force vis-a-vis non-state armed groups. So whether the Saudis or the French or the Brits or the Germans or any other country that expresses political support, that has the net effect of beginning to change the established parameters of international law. And this is why it's important to remember what I said earlier, that a state of war is an objective test. It's not legally relevant whether they declare war on us or not. What is legally relevant is that, in international law terms, a state of hostilities has reached a level and magnitude and a gravity and a geographic scope that requires the use of military force in response. And I think on these facts as we know them right now, it's hard to say that we've met the established criteria for a classic armed conflict. So what we're actually watching is an evolution with respect to non-state actors of what it means to be in a state of armed conflict. And that's what's interesting as a pure international law scholar and an international law technical expert. The technical meanings of armed conflict are beginning to change right before our eyes.
Well, again, I'm just asking these questions because I find this period, I did say on this program that this is, in a sense, Barack Obama's date with destiny. There's this call of the declaration of war that it will change dramatically a whole bunch of things and be getting, through your eyes, be getting to understand the shift in terms of the legal and implications on the international level. When the president declared war, did he, in fact, was that itself a violation of international law?
Well, I think he was using a political phrase. I mean, the concept of war, this is why I make the distinction between the political phrase warfare and the technical legal phrase armed conflict. What they're really saying is that we have the right to use force in self-defense to protect and preserve both American lives and American interests. There's no question about that. The question is the extent and the geographic scope of that lawful right to use force. So no, he wasn't violating international law. If he has a good faith basis or perhaps intelligence that has not been shared with the general public, which is always a possibility here, to show that American lives, American property are further endangered. I mean, at a core level, this is the difference between watching the horrifying execution of Americans on TV, which is a crime, and simply punishing that crime through the use of military force, which is vengeance, it's revenge, it's payback. It's a lot of things, but it's not an armed conflict. There has to be some clear understanding that we're in a state of sustained military activity against a military opponent that doesn't permit just the use of police powers. And here, the relevant control of the governments is exactly relevant because neither Syria nor Iraq can send in law enforcement and police forces and investigative teams and forensics teams to prosecute those perpetrators. So that's one of the factors that tilts towards military action, because, you know, the law enforcement, civilian, peacetime scenario is not feasible in that setting. So what the president really was saying, although in very imprecise language, is that the United States sees itself in a continuing set of hostilities with the non-state actor, and therefore the use of force is lawful, provided that they have a good faith basis of making that claim. If they don't, you can call it lots of other things, but you can't call it a state of armed conflict.
But at the time he said it, he did not have permission or consent from the national body that is supposed to do that by constitutional law. And let's suppose, I'm going to pose a hypothetical question to you. The president declares war against a country. That in turn triggers that country to take preemptive action. Let's suppose this were a country that were armed with nuclear weapons, and it chose to interpret the president's declaration of war as imminent danger to the sovereignty of its country, and therefore unleashes, on the basis of the president's statement, unleashes all manner of hell on the United States. Now, what are the international, what, therefore, by the president saying, I'm declaring war, making it basically a prediction, a statement of fact, even though at the time he did not have the power to make that pronouncement, but he did. If that should have triggered a really nasty reaction, would the president, in fact, have precipitated an unprecedented reaction by a country that would, within its rights, believe itself to be entitled to defend itself?
Well, that's an interesting hypothetical. You should have a radio show. I think you get into, I just wrote this book called Proportionality in International Law precisely on that theme. Because there are different meanings. It's the same word, proportionality, that shows up across a variety of disciplines in international law. It shows up in trade law. It shows up in bioethics law. It shows up in maritime delineation. It shows up in criminal sentencing. We say that we want criminals to have a sentence imposed that is proportionate to the gravity and severity of the crime that they've committed. So there's a proportionality principle in criminal sentencing. Well, the most important ones are the proportionality principle with respect to the lawful right to resort to the use of force in self-defense. And then the proportionality principle, once you're actually in a state of armed conflict, proportionality further constrains the lawfulness of the kinds of weapons you can use and the ways you can use them. So to take one piece of your hypothetical, based on a simple presidential declaration that we are at war against a non-state actor in your group or on your sovereign soil, on your territory, and there have been political conversations where we know for a fact that neither of those governments would be all that upset if we degraded the impact of ISIS on their territory. So it's not like we're attacking those governments directly. The use of, as you say, weapons to cause all manner of hell in response to that would absolutely be disproportionate and violative of international law, no question, because you're only allowed to use that degree of force that is strictly tailored and necessary to eliminate the threat, and even then, only as a last resort. That's in the run-up to an armed conflict. So right now, we are not at war with Syria. We are not at war with Iraq. So for them to initiate the use of weapons that would, you know, in your words, cause all manner of hell, that would violate international law. Once you cross that threshold and you're in a state of armed conflict, this is why this is important, because the meaning of the word proportionality and the way it constrains your uses of force fundamentally shifts. The entire legal regime and the meaning of proportionality is dramatically different. This is why the semantics do matter and why we have to be very clear about whether we are in an armed conflict with ISIS or not. Because if we are, then it's the proportionality principle that applies inside the law regulating the use of force. If we're not, then it's the proportionality principle in place that regulates the resort to force. And right now, we're kind of in the middle of those. We're maybe crossing the bridge, even as we speak, even today and last week, as a coalition begins to be assembled, but we're not squarely on either side of that. And that's why these debates matter, and why I believe we absolutely need to be very clear with our allies about what happens going forward. What are the parameters of that? What are the various legal understandings with respect to the use of force? Because, as I said, what we are literally watching as a coalition begins to assemble, both with military force and with political statements of support, we're watching the law change here. And, you know, then we can have longer debates about how much it's changed and why it's changed and what are the effects of that change. But we are, in fact, today watching evolution of law as reflected in state practice between states and what they view as the appropriate bounds. So, you know, it's a great time to be an international lawyer, and it's a great time to read that proportionality book because it explains many of these concepts.
But still, even as the ground shifts, there are certain things that still remain permanent, and one of them is accountability, the other is transparency, and we have gotten neither from the president. I mean, we hear what he said, but in terms of, because when military action eventually will have to stand up to accountability. So even now, as the ground is shifting, what mechanisms do you know of that are monitoring the United States actions in the inevitable time when it would have to review it in terms of accountability for or consequences of those actions?
Right. Well, let me before I answer that, I mean, the easy answer is the UN Security Council always operates as a functional overseer of these types of things, because in the UN Charter, the UN Security Council is charged with the primary responsibility for maintaining international peace and security. So that's why when there is the use of force across international borders, as, for example, in, you know, many contexts, whether it was Iraq in the first Gulf War or Kosovo when NATO used force, the Security Council absolutely has a role to assess that use of force and either criticize it, as it did in the case of Saddam invading Kuwait. There's a criticism that violated international law, or implicitly approve of that, as the Security Council did with NATO actions in Kosovo. Some would argue that was done with respect to the second Gulf War under President George W. Bush, but certainly it was done with ECOWAS forces in Western Africa. So the Security Council oversees. But let me be clear. You said accountability and transparency. To me, there's another very, very important fundamental principle here, which is clarity. We owe it to the warfighters, to the Air Force pilots, to the special forces on the ground, to the logisticians, to every United States Armed Forces member who goes and deploys in execution of the Commander-in-Chief's directive. They don't have the option. They will obey the lawful orders of the Commander-in-Chief. We owe absolute clarity to them what law governs their actions and the extent to which that law governs them. It's fundamentally, to me, it's morally wrong and both and legally imprecise to say to those people, go out and do your job. Do what we've ordered you to do. But we're not going to be really clear about what law governs that or what the rules of engagement are or what the consequences are. We owe absolute clarity to those warfighters who go out to implement the Commander-in-Chief's vision. And this is where you ask what body oversees this. As a political matter, it's the Security Council. But as a legal matter, it's the laws and customs of war. The very clear principles of the laws of war, once they are applicable, provide that kind of oversight. It's the laws of war that provide the boundaries for permissible, lawful military action. If we're not in that domain, then we need to be very clear what the political bounds are and what the legal bounds are. If we are in that domain, then we need to be very clear. We are in a state of armed conflict to which the laws and customs of war apply. Therefore, I, as your Commander-in-Chief or General Allen or CENTCOM or the appropriate military authorities, impose these rules of engagement in accordance with that body of law, because that's the kind of clarity that we owe warfighters. It's fine as a political matter and as a philosophical matter to debate the differences. And there's lots of political discussions and philosophical discussions and moral discussions to be had. But I think it's imperative. It's non-negotiable that when we send forces to the field, we give them clear guidance on what law applies and how it applies, because at the end of the day, they bear criminal responsibility for having violated those norms. So clarity, you said accountability and transparency. I would add clarity to that. And the other reason that clarity is important is because it helps. Yes, the law here is changing, and by law, I mean the law of self-defense. The parameters of the law of self-defense may be changing. We need to be very clear, both with the American people and with our allies, exactly how that law is changing. Because to the extent that the law changes and we're not clear, or there's ambiguity, well, then what we've really done is we've made conflicts between states that much more likely. We've not let international law serve the fundamental purposes that it was designed to serve, which is to constrain the uses of force between states, to have clear rules for when uses of force are permissible. And that's the whole point of international law, is to keep the peace.
Well, you mentioned the UN Security Council, and there, you know, you mentioned instances in which it made a decision, but it, of course, made a decision in favor of the United States. With no surprise, the United States basically commands the will of the UN Security Council. It has been a rare case that the UN Security Council has ever contravened the desires of the United States. So whenever it wants to get something done, it has a way of getting its way within the UN Security Council. I'm going to ask a couple of questions, and then we'll open up the phone lines at 888-874-4888 for your questions with our guest today, Professor Michael Newton. I want to go back to this issue of proportionality. Here, the United States actively now is engaged in combat in Iraq and soon in Syria. It is employing military tactics that will cost the lives of Iraqis and of Syrians. What, therefore, is considering that you had mentioned that both the Iraqi government and Syrian government should not really object to the United States taking on ISIS in their countries, but that really is not, in my view, it's not really germane, because we're still talking about sovereignty. These countries did not decide to have the United States invade their territory in order to pursue, for lack of a better term, the enemy. So they are dealing now as unwilling hosts of an invading country, seeking a party that they don't really want, which is true. They're really not ISIS fans. They don't want them in their country. But at the same time, the larger issue, it seems to be, is why would they be expected simply to tolerate an invasion of their country, especially in that it can cause a direct consequence of that invasion would be the lives of their citizens?
Well, that's a great question. Let me give a couple of answers, and then I'm happy to take questions from you or from the audience. The idea of them being unwilling hosts to an invasion, I would sort of tweak your terminology there. Right now, they're unwilling hosts to ISIS and this non-state actor that has declared, that has seized large chunks of their property. And it's not to be forgotten that under human rights law, the territorial state bears responsibility for both for the protection of the fundamental human rights of the entire set of the population on their territory. So ISIS is committing egregious violations against civilians even as we speak. It's the sovereign government, either Syria or Libya or Iraq, that bears the responsibility under human rights law for protecting all of those civilians. So you could reframe that, if the facts supported it, you could easily reframe that to say that these states were the unwilling hosts of ISIS. It was, in fact, perpetrating grave crimes that they, in their sovereign capacity, could not influence, and therefore the United States the United States-led coalition was actually facilitating the accomplishment of the human rights by protecting the population. That's why it's important.
But it's still their call. It should still be their call to issue help.
I agree. But, you know, you've not heard any protests coming from either Syria or Iraq with respect to airstrikes yet. Now, you may, over time, and then the situation changes. But right now, you've not heard protests. And so right now, today, this is a humanitarian mission, and now it's beginning to shift so that American forces, the mission is shifting beyond a narrow humanitarian mission designed to protect and to preserve fundamental human rights into a larger mission. If those countries begin to protest, then the situation changes, where you say, okay, what do you consent to? Maybe it's areas, maybe it's coordination mechanisms. It's a hypothetical at the moment. And if we're not discussing this issue already with Syrian officials or with Iraqi officials, I'd be very, very surprised. But so far you've heard no public peep of protest from either one of those governments or from the Arab League or from other countries in the region. In fact, you've seen the opposite. You've seen statements of affirmation. This is why I say the law is beginning to change. You've seen statements of affirmation, but you haven't seen the needed clarity. Affirming to what? And under what circumstances? And what parameters for the use of force? And, you know, I'm not sure I'd agree with your characterization that the United States always is going to readily get its way with the Security Council. We need only look to the situation in Ukraine to know that's not true, or the situation with respect to Syria in the last year or so. I mean, the United States can't just simply snap its fingers and have the Security Council grant us this broad authorization, because the Chinese and the Russians would typically stop that. So that's why, when innocent lives are at stake, we have to be very clear about what body of law applies. And let me say one last thing about the law of proportionality. You're absolutely right that there may well be some loss of innocent life inside Syria or inside Iraq. That's absolutely true. There are two things that flow from that. One, ISIS itself has the duty under the laws of war to refrain from any act that would endanger the civilian population. The obligation to protect civilians is one of those core principles of the laws of war that applies to both parties, absolutely binding on both parties, both the attacking party and the defending party. So they have the legal obligation to distinguish themselves from the civilian population and to stay away from civilian areas and to try to protect civilians affirmatively. Similarly, we have the affirmative obligation, and by we I mean the entire coalition, the affirmative obligation to protect civilians at all times and in all ways. The linking principle to that, then, is the proportionality principle. And that's one of those concrete principles of law by which we take one more further step to try to protect innocent civilians. And this is why this law is complicated, but the reason we have to be so clear about what we're doing, why we're doing it, and how the law specifically constrains that. And this is my fear right now. We're being so imprecise. Nobody is precisely clear what the implications are in legal terms on the ground in the actual conduct of missions. And at the end of the day, I think we owe that to the American service members and men and women that are going to bear the price for this.
Patricia from New York, you're on with Professor Michael Newton.
Yes, good afternoon. I don't want to belabor this point. I just want to make certain that I am hearing what you're saying clearly. I was speaking to a civil rights activist just this past Sunday about this very issue. And when I suggested that there were some international rules that we were violating, his response to me was, well, Syria does not mind if we go in. So he didn't understand why I was questioning whether we had a right to do so, whether on moral grounds or legal grounds. So the prevailing sentiment appears to be Syria has no objection, Iraq has no objection, so then it's okay for us to do this. So could you just clarify this maybe one more time?
Well, yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
The international law principle here is sovereignty, the territorial control of your soil and of your citizens. And Nitrich is absolutely correct to point out that it's the sovereign governments who have the human rights obligation for protecting the human rights, the right to life of the people on their territory. So Syria or Iraq has absolutely every right to protest to the use of force on its soil under any circumstances. The countervailing right would be for the United States or for some other country to say, yes, we understand you have a very limited right of sovereignty against any uses of force on your soil that are designed to overthrow your territorial independence or political integrity. That's not what we're doing. We're using a very narrow, very focused, very limited use of military force in imminent self-defense to protect our citizens, our property, our lives. We're absolutely allowed to do that. For example, we send in the Marines to evacuate U.S. civilians from Liberia. Absolutely lawful. Very limited. It's not affected against them. The larger question, though, is how far does that extend? Because it's very clear, at least to me, that we're not in the very narrow, very imminent use of force just to protect American lives and property. We're in a much, much larger, much more extended use of force, and that's where the issue of state consent comes in. But the countervailing point here is that we cannot use force in an unlawful way on their territory. In other words, in a way that violates the laws and customs of war and therefore endangers the innocent lives of other civilians. This is why we have to be very clear about what our mission is and the parameters of that mission. Now, I hope that answers your question.
Patricia? Okay, she's not there. 888-874-4888. Our guest, Professor Michael Newton, will take your questions. 888-874-4888. As things progress now, Professor Newton, what is happening within your own circle of experts and expertise? What is the conversation about the shifting in the law and the need also to respond with some degree of rapidity here, because things are changing so fast, that there's some body at work to put in place some kind of a mechanism that would help?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of discussions going on in terms of the human rights issues. One of the great ironies here is that after 9/11, in the run-up to the second Gulf War, invasion in 2003, United States policy extended the right to use force beyond just a very narrow, very limited right of imminent self-defense. We extended that policy to say that not only are we absolutely allowed to use force to do that, but we're also allowed to use force to preempt emerging threats. And the reaction, as you know, from the rest of the world and from many in the United States was vehemently to sharply object to that, to say, no, international law gives you very clear grounds, but they're very clear precisely because they're so limited. The Germans and many other European countries pushed back on that at that time. One of the great irony, and President Obama ran against that principle, that the United States had been reckless in its use of force, that we had extended the use of self-defensive force too far and waged in international law terms, what we would call an aggressive war. The irony here is that we're now doing functionally the same thing against a non-state actor. So the longer-term concern among a lot of international lawyers is, and this is why I say clarity is what's really vital here, to the extent that we change the law and we extend into preemptive uses of force against non-state actors, it also has the potential consequence of changing that body of law with respect to the lawful scope of relationships between states. And this is what's interesting now, is that you're having many of the same countries that objected to the 2003 Iraq War absolutely expressing support for this current effort. That's why I say clarity in terms of the law is what's very, very important. The other thing is, there's a big debate among international lawyers about the lawfulness of the use of force, even in situations to protect humanitarian interests. And that's another area here where I think you're beginning to see the law change, where if there truly is a humanitarian imperative, we used force without Security Council authorization, and I didn't hear a single voice in the world, really, that said, no, you cannot lawfully use force to protect civilians that are suffering from certainly crimes against humanity and arguably acts of genocide. So again, that's another area where the law may well be changing before our very eyes.
From New Jersey, Frankie, you're on the air with Michael Newton.
Yes. The caliphate, ISIS, they're paying their troops 10 times what the U.S. is paying people. Can the professor talk on that?
that's really kind of outside of our scope, but I'll see. Thank you.
I'm just not sure I understand the question.
He was saying that the ISIS is paying its troops at a higher rate than the Iraqi soldiers are getting paid, and I don't know how that figured into our conversation today, but
No, I'm not sure. Except it does indicate, though, to me. I mean, we focused on the military uses of force and on the you know, as we would say in the military context, what is your mission statement? And what are the specified and implied tasks? In other words, what is the mission statement? Destroy ISIS. That's great. That's a nice little soundbite from the president's speech. But that means nothing in practical terms. The mission statement, the very broad statement, destroy ISIS, has to be broken down what the military would call specified and implied tasks. One of the things that, to my ear, I heard missing from the president's statement that I have yet to see from U.S. officials is a very clear articulation of the specified tasks. I want to see verbs like interdict, stop, kill. Very precise verbs. Those are the specified tasks. And one of those has to be, in my view, the broadest use of U.S. power. So it may be that they're paying a lot more money. We absolutely have to interdict, stop, dry up the flow of funding to ISIS. That means interfering with the flow of oil into Turkey, which has been documented. That means interfering with the banking accounts that are funding ISIS. That means interfering with the underground networks for the flow of money. We've got to dry up the source of that funding. And that would be one of the clear mission tasks, the specified tasks that I would see, or I would hope to see, coming from a very broad mission statement. But I think the point is, at least for me, and I think this is what the caller is alluding to, this is not just a military problem. There's a financial aspect of this, there's a diplomatic aspect of this, and there's a trade aspect to this, there's a legitimacy aspect to this. I want to see all of those efforts being utilized, because in the end, those set the conditions of success for the military campaign. If we do just a military campaign, it is necessary but not sufficient if we're going to meet the president's goal of destroying ISIS.
Well, that brings us close to the end of our program today, Professor Newton. I just want to thank you for allowing us to take this tour with you of the changing nature of international law and how it applies to the situation that is unfolding. And I think you opened our eyes to this question about exactly where the world of international law is. It's itself trying to adjust to these fast unfolding events, and it would be an interesting thing to see what the responses will be, especially in the next few days, as this situation seems to be intensifying. So I want to thank you so much for being with us today and giving us the benefit of your time and your expertise.
I'm delighted to do that. I mean, I one of the reasons I wrote this new book called Proportionality in International Law is precisely to make available these complex analyses and the history available to everybody on the street. So if you really want to understand, as you say, what we do to prevent the loss of innocent life and how these bodies of law fit together, it's in that book. And it's very important, I think, for the American people to understand. I mean, I'm a West Point graduate. It's very important for the United States, for the American people to understand why we send our men and women into harm's way. And if we're not absolutely unified that it's the right thing to do, and if the president hasn't made that case in a way that's persuasive, then we need to be asking hard questions of the administration. If they can make that case and there's sufficient support under international law, then it's a different conversation. But I think the burden is on the actor, in this case the Western coalition, joined by whatever members of the Arab League, to affirmatively make that case. And that's where I hope people really stay engaged to watch us make that case affirmatively.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of our program. I hope it was useful. I hope it helped you think about this business of warfare in the context of international law. It will, of course, be the subject that we'll pursue because it is about to get really, really, really hairy. I did say, you know, not that the speech itself was going to be historic. This is a historic moment for the president and for the country and for the world, because a lot is going to start happening now that will set precedents. And it may not be necessarily the kind that we want, but it is nonetheless momentous, and we really need to pay attention to that. Thank you so much for joining me today. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow. And you would want to drop me a note if you can at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company.